Well, in Exodus chapters 1 and 2, which we've already done, it started by all introducing the main characters of the drama. Firstly, the descendants of the sons of Israel, so that, in other words, the 12 tribal groups as slaves in Egypt. Then we saw the fear of the Pharaoh for this group that was growing so vast, as the story tells us anyhow, and the midwives were given instructions to kill all the boys. And in a comical way, in a way, the great power of the Pharaoh, who was the greatest power on earth, is thwarted by these two women. So I think you're meant to smile at that, and I think we're meant to think, all these powerful people aren't as powerful as they think they are, that God is the one that's actually organising this thing. Then we introduce to Moses, and he's preserved from the swirling waters, and you've got to go back to the chaos in the chapter 1 of Genesis, and you've got to go back to the flood, so-called, the Mabul flood of the chapter 9 and so on. And like Noah, he is preserved from the flood in a teba, a sacred temple-like something that keeps him preserved, just as Noah will be later. And then Moses, as a man, finds out who he is. He's been brought up in the Pharaoh's court, and he tries to defend some habiru, some of his own people, from the Egyptian taskmasters. In fact, he kills one of the taskmasters, but gets him nowhere. He can't succeed on his own. He has to flee. And the lesson in there should be obvious, though I had to hurry it last evening, is that success in the cause of justice has to come from God and has to wait on God's instruction. Not Moses on himself couldn't do it, in other words. It would only be a far more important pressure brought to bear. And right at the end of chapter 2, we're told that Yahweh, he's introduced, God is introduced for the first time. Yahweh remembers. He hears the cry of the poor. He remembers the promises made in the book of Genesis to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and so Yahweh is going to do something about this situation. So they're the first two chapters. We move now to chapter 3. Moses, in exile, is keeping a flock of his father-in-law, Jethro. Jethro, in chapter 2, is called Ruel, and in another thing he's called Hobab. I haven't the faintest idea what his name was, because there are different traditions, you see. Some of them probably came from the sacred sites of Joseph. Some may have come from the down at Beersheba in their stories. And the stories differ, but the people putting the Bible together wanted to keep it all in case. It's all sacred stuff, so they don't mind contradictions. They don't mind having different stuff clashing in their Bible, because it does, because they're all thinking, oh, there's something mysterious happening here, and we better keep it all so that God's will won't be missed. So you have all these traditions. Anyhow, he's called Jethro in this text. He's a priest of Midian. He led his flock, that's Moses, beyond the wilderness, and he came to Horeb. Well, Horeb is one of the traditions too, probably from the north. It's called Sinai in other traditions, and again, both are kept. The mountain of God. Horeb just means the desert mountain, the mountain in the desert. It's unnamed in a way. There, the angel of Yahweh appeared to Moses in a flame of fire out of a bush. Angel of Yahweh, what does that mean? He's not talking about angels, these amazing creatures that God made. Angel of Yahweh is always Yahweh. But of course, Yahweh is transcendent. So you can't see God and you can't hear God. So it's a way of speaking of God mediated somehow, mysteriously. It's the experience of God, but they're not claiming it's God that they're actually hearing. It's the angel of Yahweh, sometimes called the spirit of Yahweh. There are different ways. It's a way of preserving the sacred transcendence, but the real connection between God and us. So the angel of Yahweh appeared to him in a flame of fire out of a bush. He looked, the bush was blazing, yet it was not consumed. Then Moses said, I must turn aside and look at this great sight and see why the bush is not burned up. When Yahweh saw that Moses had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, come no closer. Remove the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you stand is holy ground. And he said further, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look on God. Then Yahweh said, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. My people, so there's something special going on here. I've heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings. And I've come down from heaven, to deliver them from the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey. And honey in that text doesn't mean bee honey. It's talking about the sweet syrup from dates. So it's sweet. It's a sweet syrup, and they translated honey here. To the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. I mentioned them in the opening lecture. So I've come to deliver, to redeem. Let's comment on that for briefly. Galatians 4, Paul's earliest letter, I suggest, verses 4 to 7. God sent his son, born of a woman, born under the law, to redeem, so the same word in Hebrew, to redeem those who were under the law, so that we might receive adoption as children. And because you are children, God has sent the Spirit of his Son into our hearts, crying, Abba. An Aramaic word. It's not Hebrew, it's Aramaic, which is a related to languages. Abba, Jesus' language is Abba, Father, translated. So you're no longer a slave, but a child. And if a child, also an heir through God. Letter to Titus, chapter 2, 14. Our Saviour Jesus Christ gave himself for us that he might redeem us. And that word comes from Exodus. It comes from the Ancient Testament. It always has in its mind the redemption of slaves from Egypt to the Promised Land. Well, it's the same word here, but it's a different kind of slavery. For all iniquity, and purify for himself a people of his own, zealous for good works. Back to chapter 3 of Exodus, verse 9. The cry of the Israelites, says God from the burning bush, has now come to me. I've seen how the Egyptians oppress them. So come, I'll send you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. Moses said to God, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt?" And God said, "I will be with you." You all know the last scene in Matthew's Gospel, Jesus on the mountain, sending them to the whole world now, whole nations. And he says, "I will be with you." It's the last words of Matthew's Gospel to the end of the age. This "I will be with you" is a common theme through all the Old Testament and therefore into the New. Important point that I'm going to now, I put in there the English spelling, because you don't know Hebrew. If you do know Hebrew, I'm sorry, but I'm not presuming you do. "I will be with you," Eye, that's the English spelling, E-H-Y-E-H, Imak, Im is with, and Ak is you. So, "I will be with you" is Eye Imak in Hebrew, and that's going to be important very soon to make that connection. And the text goes on, "This shall be the sign for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you will worship God on this mountain." So we're clearly at Horeb. This "I will be with you," just some meditation on it for a minute. Exodus 3:12, we just had God say to Moses, "I will be with you." Genesis 26:3 to Isaac, "I will be with you. I will bless you." Genesis 31:3 to Jacob, "I will be with you." Deuteronomy 31:23 to Joshua, "I will be with you." So we're getting the message, I think. Whatever mission you're on, if you try and do it on your own, like Moses did before he got exiled, you won't get anywhere. But if I am with you, if God is with you, and he will be with you, if you're on his mission, doing his will, then everything's possible. Judges 6:16 to Gideon, "I will be with you." And I could give you more, but that's surely enough. Isaiah 7:14, the sign that here you're going to come to Mount Sinai and I'll meet me there. The sign here in Isaiah 7:14 is a young woman is with child. It could be the king's wife, and the child could well be Hezekiah. It's not foreseeing the future. The prophets didn't foresee the future. They spoke to real people in their real situation about their real, what was going on. They saw, they are seers. They look into the depth of things. And sometimes they do talk about the future, like the immediate future. If you don't do this, this will happen to your children, that kind of stuff you find in the prophets. Sometimes when they talk about the future, it's always vague. It's always a statement about God. Whatever happens in the future, and they haven't got the foggiest idea of that, God will be there. God will be with you. So it's kind of the lamb will lie down with the lion, and like peace will come and all that. Prophecy can't be understood as looking at a crystal ball and foreseeing the future. All through the New Testament, because prophecy is so important, the way you have to read it is Matthew, for example, is looking at his situation, Jesus, and what's happening in his world. And he's trying to make as many connections between that and the Bible as he can, of course, because he's trying to convince his brother-in-law and his sister and his nieces, the Jews, to come into the Christian community. So he keeps taking them back to these texts and saying, "Look at that text and look at what happened here. This fulfills that." Not that foresaw this, but this is the flowering of your spirituality, your poetry, your dreams, your hopes, your prophecies. They're all fulfilled in Jesus. I hope that's clear. So it's a kind of a trajectory back, not a trajectory forward. In any case, in this text, and Luke is going to use this, as you know, in the Annunciation scene, a young woman, Luke will actually put in a virgin, which the Hebrew has not virgin, it's got a young woman, Alma. It's not Parthenos. But in the Greek Old Testament, because they lived in a world where Zeus was having it off with every virgin he could find, basically, in the thing. And so in the Greek Old Testament, this text is translated by Parthenos, virgin, which is then picked up in the New Testament, which uses the Greek Bible, because they're writing in Greek. So anyhow, in the original text, the young woman, as I said, possibly the king's wife, is with child and will bear a son. And you're to name him Immanuel. Im with, we've had that already. Manu, with you. U is you here. El is God. God with you. So to name the child Immanuel means God is going to be with you. So don't get caught up in all this other stuff. Isaiah 43:2. When you pass through the waters, I will be with you. We're not alone. And through the rivers, they will not overwhelm you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you. Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. It was not I, says Paul. It was the grace of God that is with me. Obviously a favourite theme. Now back to Exodus. And we're on to something very important here. Exodus 3:13-14. Moses said to God, if I come to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your ancestors has sent me to you, and they ask me, what's his name? What am I to say to them? Every God has a name. The God of the mountain, the God of the stars, the God of the moon, the God. There's gods everywhere. And they've all named by where they are in the world. So that's what. So who are you? Are you the God of Sinai? Are you the. Who are you? What's your name? And it's very important to listen to God's answer. Eye, we just had that word. It means I will be with you. Eye imak. Eye asher hu eye. It's translated in the Greek Old Testament again, is the English, I am who I am. And that's quite a possible translation of it. Because the Hebrew doesn't have distinctions between present and future. They use the same form, and you have to work out from the context. So I am who I am is an allowable translation of the Hebrew Eye Asher Eye. In the light of the context, however, I think it should be translated I will be who I will be, which is clearer. I am who I am sounds like a very profound Greek, by the way, philosophical statement. The Hebrews don't have philosophical statements. They're very practical language. But the Greeks do. So this could be an ontological, nothing wrong with it, an ontological statement. I am who I am. Sounds good, and it's big, and it involves everything. But if it's I will be who I will be, it's telling Moses, you can't name me. You can't pigeonhole me. You can't have theology about me. You can't put me in chapter 2 of your catechism. I'm God. And I'll be who I will be. You'll find me as you move on. You just get on with it. Like Jesus said to the disciples, go on to Galilee. I will meet you there. We'll find God as we step. We haven't got God, but every step we take, God will be there with us, and he will be who he will be. We've got to trust it. It's quite powerful and very good and very true, obviously. But I think it's what's said here. I will be who I'll be. Just you relax. Don't try and name me. Trust me. I'll be there. And you'll find me as you walk. And God said further, verse 14, thus you shall say to the Israelites, Eye has sent me to you. I am, if you want a Greek philosophical statement, I will be, if you want a trust word from the Hebrew, I will be has sent me to you. You can't name me. I will be. God also said to Moses, thus you shall say to the Israelites, and here's the first occurrence in the Bible of, I won't call it the name, but you nearly have to say name, Yahweh. Yahweh. And you can see by the spelling in the English, H's and Y's and etc. Yahweh is a unique word, doesn't occur any other thing except in relation to the God who revealed himself to Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, etc. And it's obviously formed from the verb to be. But you can't, it's not in the declension of the verb because it doesn't exist anywhere else. But it's clearly connected. There's a connection between Eye and Yahweh, which is obvious. But here is the sacred name. Am I allowed to use that word in word? What I call the sacred form of the language which refers to this God. So every time you see Yahweh, you must think of the burning bush. You must think of the God who redeemed Israel. You must. It's a historical term about action, not about place. Yahweh. Now that's translated, just to finish it off for you, I hope I'm not telling you too much, but because Yahweh is, I'll say, the name, the kind of word that associates directly with this mysterious transcendent God of the Israelites, but the God of the world and the God of creation, it kind of builds up. The second commandment said, you shall not take the name of Yahweh in vain. It's a good commandment. To avoid taking the name of Yahweh in vain, the practice grew up quite late in Judaism, but pre-Christian, of not using the name at all. And then you're sure not to take it in vain, aren't you? So they translated it into Adonai, which in Hebrew means Lord. So instead of saying Yahweh, and in the text you'll see Yahweh written in Hebrew with an asterisk, and down in the footnote it says, say Adonai. And then you're not taking the name of the Lord in vain. You're saying Lord. Now Adonai is translated into the Greek as Kurios, and Kurios into the English as Lord. Hence, throughout the Bible, except in the Jerusalem Bible, thank God, and in the New Jerusalem Bible, they always translate this word, not Yahweh, but Lord. You with me? Yeah, that's the word they keep using, and it's the appropriate word for speech in a Jewish context. In English, because the Jews don't like hearing, if this was a Jewish community here, I wouldn't be saying Yahweh, because out of respect for their preference or their habit. But I'm not afraid to say it here to you. And what I've done throughout all my commentaries, and many, say, scholars do, is just put the consonants. So the consonants as read, you can say Lord, you can say Adonai, they're the consonants without the vowels. So it's not written in a recognisable way to be spoken. Anyhow, if I may, I'll continue to use the word Yahweh to sound that tetragrammaton, that four-letter word. Thus you shall say to the Israelites, Yahweh, the God of your ancestors, the God of Abram, Isaac, and Jacob, has sent me to you. I'm showing you there an icon of Jesus and the beloved disciple. This is all Greek here, and that's French. I will betroth you to myself in tenderness, is from the Hosea prophecy. But what I want you to watch is, around this halo, there are Greek words. Ho in Greek means the. You'll often see this in icons of Christ. Omega Nun means Ho'on, means the one. Well, Eye, Asher, Eye, which is what's the Hebrew here, I will be who I will be, is translated in the Septuagint, that's 200 BC, Greek translation of the Hebrew. Ego, Eimi, I am, ego, ego, Eimi, I am. Ho'on, the one. I am the one, is how you'd read it in Greek. I am the one, so I am who I am. Well, when you get to the New Testament, and when you get to the sacred icons of Jesus, whenever you see Ho'on, you know that the writer of the icon or the author of the writing is talking about the divinity of Jesus. Jesus as the revelation of Yahweh. You got the connection? So he's the and divinity, you can start two ways of approaching the divinity of Jesus. One of them, I have to suggest to you, doesn't work, even though it's often used. It doesn't work. The other one does work, and I suggest to you it's the one you should. They call about descending Christology. Descending Christology means you start with God, you start with the Trinity, and you work your way down to Jesus. If you do that, and that's what everyone did when I was young, you don't end up with Jesus at all. You don't end up with a human Jesus. You end up with some, I don't know what you end up with, but you have all these colossal problems because the divine second person of the Blessed Trinity, why we bring maths into it, I don't know, but we do, becomes man, and we have the problems. You mightn't have them, but I did in the seminary. Everyone knew Jesus was God. We never talked about it. It was so obvious. It's our faith. But was Jesus really man? You know? Was he really a man like us in everything except sin? Did he have a human mind? Did he have a human heart? Did he have a human love? Did he have all this human stuff? Not really, you know, because he knew everything. Do you see what I'm trying to get at? He was God. So somehow we had Jesus with two heads, a divine one and a human one. I'm putting it badly, but it was a bit like that. So how could he do this? If he was God, how could he choose Judas? Really? If he was God, how could he say, I don't know about the last day? If he was God, how could he say to the rich young man, don't call me good, only God is good? If he's God, what's he doing when he prays to God? Is he praying to himself? Do you know what I mean? Hope I'm giving you the general drift of it. We end up with a mixed up, two-natured person who's not really human like us. That's the problem with descending Christology. If you do ascending Christology, which is, everyone does it, you start where the disciples start. You start with someone who's clearly a man, who didn't know, who wept, who maybe got his bit of Latin that he picked up as a kid, got it mixed up because it was a second language to him, or third language, whose Greek was a bit... not a Greek speaker would say, well, he's obviously from the country or something. You know what I mean? He was human. He had to learn like we have to learn. He had to grow in wisdom and knowledge, and as Luke tells us, and everybody knows. And he was really good at carpentry, but not that good at fishing, because he wasn't a fisherman. Well, the others didn't. But every time we read about the others fishing in the gospel, by the way, they never catch anything. So it'll teach you how good they were either. But I hope you see what I'm trying to say. Start with Jesus' humanity, human mind, human heart, human tears, human laughter, human learning. All of that's absolutely like us. The only thing he isn't like us is that he never sinned. What does that mean? It means he kept loving no matter what happened to him. He just kept loving. And he was totally believing in God. And as we do in that icon, what they want us to do, John, that's John's gospel I'm talking about, John's gospel knows all that, but penetrates into the mystery of this wonderful, trying to think, who is he? Where does he get this loving from? Where does he get this insight from? Who is Jesus really? And it takes us into the heart of Jesus, which means his prayer, which means his communion with God and his oneness with God. Now, that's argued about because you might know some of the early church history, and it gets onto Arius and it gets onto the Council of Nicaea. And granted, the questions being asked, the Council of Nicaea gave great answers to those questions. They're not my questions. They're not our questions. They're not our kids' questions. So we've got to be careful about repeating the answer when the kids aren't asking that question. It's not connecting. So we've got that as a Greek background, but much better than the Greek background, we've got the Gospels. We've got the Gospel of John. And the most beautiful thing that John says is, Jesus says, I am in the Father and the Father is in me. I and the Father are one. Well, you're not going to get better than that. And that's much more simple, direct, wonderful than an abstract statement about homoousios with the Father. And if you don't speak Greek, you don't know what homoousios means. One substance with the Father. And you don't know what substance means. I'm sorry, you do know what substance means, but that's not what substance means in the Council of Nicaea. It's a translation of hypostasis, etc. So we're getting words. We say, you might say, there are three persons in God. You're a heretic. Because person today means an individual with his or her own consciousness and will, etc. No, if you say there are three persons in God today, you're saying there are three gods. And that's how the Muslims hear you say it. No wonder they're angry with Christians. There's only one God, they say. Christians say there's only one God. But then we complicate it by saying three persons, using a word, person, to translate the Greek. Oh, I'm going too far, aren't I? But I don't want to frighten you, but I want to just help you realise that theology is a very, very delicate thing, and we've got to know what we're saying and know how to say it to connect. And don't use words that actually disconnect, because the words have changed over time and mean something different today than they did in the time of St. Augustine, for example. Well, I'm sorry I went into all that, but I'm doing it because this ho'on, Jesus is divine. Through him, Paul puts it better than anybody, God was reconciling the world through Christ. God was reconciling the world to himself. So as we watch Jesus, we're watching how God's human face, God's human love, God's human tears, God's human words, that's what we're getting. So where God is hearable, seeable by looking at Jesus. He who sees me sees the Father, says Jesus. So we're seeing that, and we're seeing he is human, so we're seeing all the human stuff that we have too, except sin, which is a big exception. We're watching the prayer of Jesus, the communion with the Father, his divinity. But we're not getting an insight into God with three persons somewhere in heaven. Oh, I've exhausted myself. I don't know how you're all going. John chapter 4. A Samaritan woman came to draw water, and Jesus said to her, give me a drink. That's lovely for a start. He's thirsty. He asks her for something. He doesn't say, I'm Jesus, I've got a lot to give you. What would you like? He says, I'm thirsty. Would you give me something to drink? He needs her because she's got the bucket and he hasn't. Well, if he's God, why doesn't he just... Do you know what I mean? He's man. So a man without a bucket can't get water out of a well down there. So he says, give me something to drink. So the Samaritan woman said, etc., you know the story. So how is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink of me, a woman of Samaria? And then she goes on to explain why. Jesus said, look, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you life-giving water, running water, spring water, not stale water out of a well. Everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. Those who drink of the water that I'll give them will never be thirsty for anything else than this spring of water that comes from God. The water that I will give you will become in you a spring of water gushing up to eternal life. And the woman goes on to say, well, I'd love that. And we all say, I'd love that. The woman said to him, I know that the Messiah is coming, the one's called the Christ. When he comes, he will proclaim all things to you. And Jesus said to her, I am the one speaking to you. Greek, ego, eimi, ho'o. No? I am the one who's speaking to you. It's not I am he. You don't keep that out of it. These words, if you're a Greek speaker, and the people who read the New Testament clearly were, or heard it when it was spoken, when they hear ego, eimi, they think of the burning bush. You've got to. They think of the God of Mount Sinai, who heard the cry of the poor. That's the echo in this ego, eimi. Yahweh is speaking to you. Chapter 6 of John. When evening came, the disciples went down to the sea, got into the boat and started across the sea to Capernaum. Sea is always dangerous. Sea is the uncontrollable element. You can't fence it, you can't plow it, you can't organize, you can't control it. It's chaos. It goes right down to hell. It's demonic stuff, these swirling waters. It was now dark. Oh God, you're in the sea and it's dark. And Jesus hadn't come to them. The sea became rough because a strong wind was blowing. And when they had rowed about 3 or 4 miles, they saw Jesus walking on the sea. What does that mean? Does it mean that Jesus was actually got feet like a duck? And he's walking on the sea? Well, give us a break. Jesus either swam or got out of the water or drowned. They are his choices because he's like us. He's human. So when it says he's walking on the water, you've got to know all the Psalms, the book of Job, all the Old Testament. He's saying, God, if I get on the water, I sink. But God rides above the chaos. God is not dragged down into it. Jesus isn't dragged down into the chaos of human sin and confusion. He's above it. Not because he's superhuman, but because he's lovingly human. Jesus walked on water when he was on Calvary. There's no water there, but are you with me? Water is chaos. And walking on it means rising above it. So, and just to prove my point, they were terrified, and he said to them, ego, eimi, I am. We're talking about the divinity of Jesus. We're talking about his communion with the Father. We're talking about God being in him. Don't be afraid. So once again, that ego, eimi, it doesn't in English necessarily, but you've got to get it. It connects us back to the burning bush. Listen to Jesus. I am the bread of life. I am. Ego, eimi. There's sometimes in the Gospel of John, I am is the translation of the English, but hasn't got ego, eimi. I'm only giving you ones where ego, eimi, because you can just say eimi, I am. You don't need ego. I am is stressed, underlined, connected. The bread of life, etc. It goes on to talk about that. I am the light of the world. When you've lifted up for the Son of Man, you'll realize that I am. Very truly, before Abraham was, I am. I think I've made the point enough. I am the gate. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I'm the way, the truth, of the light and the life. I am the vine. 7 times, and that's not an accident, John unpacks this I am, bread of life, all the aspects of the I am in Jesus. And I've just given them to you rather hurriedly, but they're there. John's account of the capture of Jesus in the garden. Read the Matthew, Mark or Luke. And they come with soldiers. There's an agony in the garden, which doesn't happen in John's gospel, by the way. Doesn't mean he didn't think it happened. He's just not interested in it. He's showing us the divinity of Jesus. We're not watching the turmoil of Jesus' heart breaking down and not knowing and crying out and
human stuff. He takes that for granted. And then he tells us the story of the capture. And the comparison between John, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, there's no comparison. It's because he wants to tell us something else which you won't see unless with John you're leaning against the heart of Jesus and listening deep down. Matthew and Mark and Luke give us the facts simply, how he was captured. And they're not all identical, but they're pretty well identical. They're giving us what happened, simply. John's saying, wait a minute, there was a lot more happening in the garden than you can read in the Synoptic Gospels. Judas brought a detachment of soldiers together with police. Ah, the others don't have soldiers, they just have police. So the Romans are there too. The whole world is there capturing Jesus. And the Pharisees, and they came with lanterns and torches and weapons. And Jesus, knowing all that was to happen to him, came forward and asked them, who are you looking for? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus said, I am. Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When Jesus said to them, I am, they stepped back and fell to the ground. This is a theophany. This is a revelation of God. Well, God was being, even though they didn't get it, they didn't pick up, they just grabbed him and hurled him off and bashed him up. But the fact is that this is God here. This is God made man. This is the human incarnation of God. So they fall back. Again he asked them, who are you looking for? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. He told you. He said, I am. So let the others go free. And here's Jesus, the best theology of the Trinity is here. John chapter 10 verse 30 says, the Father and I are one. They're not identical. He's not praying to himself when he prays to the Father. That would be heresy, and you know that. So Jesus isn't the Father, but they're one. Believe what I do so that you may know and understand that the Father is in me and I am in the Father. You can't put it better than that. None of the councils of the church put it better than that. They put it worse than that because they're debating in a different language, in a different situation, and the questions being asked by Arius and other people are wacko questions, to be quite honest. If you read Arius, he's got demigods and he's got all kinds of damn things that were rushing around in their world. So they've got to answer it with it to those people, and they're consistent entirely with the Gospels, which they have to be. But the Gospels are actually more modern than the theology of those councils, because they're just in a different world. So we're both in chapter 10, and look at chapter 14. Do you not believe that I am in the Father, and the Father is in me? Can't put it better than that.